Blog Talk Radio.
Now, in its second edition, Carol Dean's popular book, The Art of Film Funding, has 12 new chapters to cover all areas of film financing and how to avoid expensive pitfalls. Learn how to start with an idea and end with a trailer. How to make an ask for money. Create your story structure and your trailer. Legal advice, fair use, successful crowdfunding, how to ask for music rights, and what insurance you can't shoot without. Available on Amazon under Carol Dean and at FromTheHeartProductions.com. Hi, and welcome to The Art of Film Funding. I'm your co-host, Claire Papin, along with Carol Dean, author of the best-selling book, The Art of Film Funding. Carol is also the founder and president of From the Heart Productions and the host of this show. David Raiklin, our guest, is a producer, composer, songwriter, host, and crowdfunder who began studying keyboard and composing at age 5. He wrote, directed, and scored his first film at age 9, and David studied composition at USC and Cal Arts and later taught at those universities. Among his mentors are Oscar winner John Williams and Pulitzer Prize winner Mel Powell, and David works for Fox, Sony, Disney, Sprint, Mattel, Warner Brothers, and PBS, in addition to many independent producers. He's scored hundreds of films, television shows, video games, and live events, winning multiple awards, including an American Music Center grant, 3 Telly Awards, and the Park City Festival Audience Choice Award, and Gold Medal. David has also composed music and sound design for theater, dance, television, mobile, museums, concerts, documentaries, and features, including the New York Film Critics' Top 10 films, Heist, I Am Omega, Disney's Sing Me a Story, Batgirl, Max Steel, trailers for the X-Files and Witchblade movies, Atlantis, Fallen Idol with Elliot Gould, My Country with Martin Sheen, and Worth, winner of over 30 international prizes and awards, including the shortlist for an Academy Award. And David is also a host of Sci-Fi Soundtrack, appearing on the Hugo-winning Starship Sofa series. He's a frequent lecturer at colleges, including UCLA, USC, Emperor's College, and Cal Arts, and at conventions. He's a member of the board of the Academy of Scoring Arts, that is, and he's serving as a producer on the sensational new science fiction series Space Command, setting a funding record for a scripted non-sequel on Kickstarter, plus composing the epic score. He's also scoring a documentary on the Lakers featuring Jerry Buse, Kobe Bryant, and Phil Jackson. I hope I did not demolish those names. He's also producing and composing for Blood Kiss, A Tale of Golden Age Hollywood with Vampires featuring Neil Gaiman's acting debut. And David was recently interviewed on the Entertainment Weekly and ABC News shows about his work. We are so grateful to have you on the show with us today, David. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here, Claire.
So David has been a donor to the grant, Claire, for many years, and David composed the music for the award-winning film Heist, who was a winner of the grant. That's the most recent one, but David helps independent filmmakers on a daily basis, and he writes music that raises their film into a much higher level. So David, your life is so full of exciting things that I think let's start with the music composing. Then
yes.
Go to crowdfunding and some of the other wonderful things you're doing. Okay with you?
That sounds like a plan. Where would you like to start?
So what films are you currently composing music for?
Well, I'm very fortunate to be working on a film that you introduced me to, Mia. Mia is the story of an incredible superstar of ballet from the era where dancers could be stars just by dancing. You know, people like Fred Astaire and Martha Graham, they had charismatic star power because they were great artists in dance. And Mia Slovenska was a artist of comparable power and appeal, and her life story is what the documentary is all about, her amazing art and her even more amazing at times dramatic life. And the reason that I got involved with this amazing once-in-a-lifetime project is because of you, Carol. You were kind enough to put me into contact with the filmmakers after they won the Dean Grant. So I've been working on that for a good while now, and we're heading towards a we're hoping for mid-November 2014, just a few months away, that it'll be shown on PBS.
Oh, my gosh, that's wonderful. This is really an exciting story. And she's a good filmmaker. Did you enjoy working with her?
Well, the person that's directing, Kate Johnson, is an amazing director, an amazing editor, and an amazing CG artist. That's quite a combination, and I don't know that I've ever worked with someone who has that many talents before. So she's been a wonderful giving person, and it's been inspiring.
Oh, how exciting. That's good. Well, I think that will be a brilliant film. So, but you're also working on a documentary about the Lakers. So tell us, how's that going?
Well, that's about the 33-game winning streak. And that recently just had its 40th anniversary. No one's come close to winning 33 games in a row in a professional league. It's almost unbelievable accomplishment. And in the process of making the film, we got to work with 13 Hall of Famers, which is a record, we think, for any program to have that many members of Sports Hall of Fame, in this case the Basketball Hall of Fame, all participating in the same show. So that's been wonderful, and I got to briefly work with Jerry Buss. So now I have that I've worked with a billionaire on my resume.
Whoa, what fun that is. I think that's great. 33 games in a row and 13 Hall of Famers. That's going to be an exciting doc. And
yes,
when is that scheduled for release, do you think?
Well, that's one that I can't give you a good answer on as soon as possible. Basically, it's just finding the right distribution, because this is an independent film, even though it was done with the blessing of the Lakers in the NBA. It's not actually an NBA film, which is a first, but that also makes it a little bit more complicated for distribution. So watch this space, and we'll let you know as soon as it's available.
Right. I bet the number of releases involved in this is horrendous. Yes. I bet the producer, this is a 10-armed producer working on this film.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, that's my friend Elliot Hamoff, who's not only produced but distributed over 300 documentaries. So even for him, it's a bit of a challenge, but he's up to it.
Great.
And that's
great.
One of the wonderful things about being a composer or just working in film industry and entertainment. You get to work with other amazing, talented people, and that's where I get so much of my day-to-day enjoyment, is working with wonderful folks like you.
Oh, how kind. Thank you so much. It is. It's all a joint effort working together is what makes them so wonderful. Not only for us who work behind the scenes, but for those who enjoy it. So tell me about your producing and composing for Blood Kiss.
Yes.
This is you're moving into producing. Tell us more about that.
Well, I think I'll start with a little backstory on Space Command, because that's how I started getting screen credit as a producer, which is something that I'd always done to just get the film made. To me, the most important thing is Do we have a good story? Is it going to be a good movie? And anything I can do to make that possible, whether it's bring in a cinematographer or get an awesome song placed or help with the perfect location, whatever it takes to get the film done, I've just always been ready to do what I can to get the film finished and get it see the light. But the process of getting Space Command off the ground, and now it's flying quite high. We were just off of a triumphant presentation at Comic-Con in San Diego where we had an absolutely packed house. We had a press junket where we couldn't fit in all of the press that wanted to see us. We had to schedule additional days and hours. And then we had a signing where the line was out the door as far as the eye could see. Just a tremendous fan response. And it all started with an idea that Mark Scott Zickrey had back in 2011, that we could bring back the hopeful and optimistic science fiction that was prevalent in the 1950s and 1960s. People like Robert Heinlein, Isaac Asimov, Ray Bradbury, Arthur C. Clarke, these people who began in the pulps and then expanded into more mainstream books and magazines and then eventually movies, had a sense that tomorrow would be better than today. They all worked in a shared universe, unofficially, where a combination of technology and enlightenment would lead to a better tomorrow. And sure, there was also dystopic, scary visions of the future, too. But there was an overall sense of optimism and that tomorrow could be better than today. And
yes,
somewhere starting in the 90s and then up to the present, the positive vision of the future was pushed aside, and dystopic, horrible future became what we saw in movies and TV. And, for example, in the 1980s, we could have a movie about E.T., a friendly alien. That's almost inconceivable that it could happen today because every movie that has aliens, they're horrible monsters that are out to destroy humanity. Well, that's one way to look at aliens, but it's certainly not the only one. Yet it is the only one that the corporate model is supporting, and it's been that way for decades. Well, Mark didn't want to settle for that. He had a hopeful, positive vision of the future, and we decided to go ahead and make our own film. Now, doing a science fiction film in the 21st century as an independent production is a huge challenge because the technical bar has been raised so high by films like Star Wars and Avatar, where tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars are spent on the visual effects. But we found that it's possible to do very high-quality work for a low price if the story is inspiring. You can get top professionals to work with you if what you're presenting is truly inspiring, truly fresh and different, something that they believe in. Now, there's still costs. There's still hard costs, and we had to be devised for raising that money. And that's where Kickstarter came in. In 2012, we ran our Kickstarter campaign, and we were basically looking for enough money to kind of get the project started at what it would cost to make like a low-budget indie horror movie. And instead, we ended up tripling, almost quadrupling our goal in just a few weeks, and we actually had enough to really begin production on a quality feature. And the footage from that was shown at San Diego at the tier, what I was just telling you about. So I was the manager for that crowdfunding campaign where we set a record on Kickstarter for an original non-sequel. And we found that our supporters were all over the world, including people in Hollywood who were making multi-million-dollar movies and had top-rated TV shows, but they were actually contributing to our campaign because they wanted to see independent filmmaking, and they wanted to see a hopeful vision of the future. So we're hoping that this will inspire
more people. If you were so successful, I just want to talk a minute about what your secrets to success were for that campaign, David. Because I remember a conversation you and I had, and I mentioned that a man who was running an Indiegogo campaign through From the Heart had made his trailer over three times, and after the third time he really got it right. And you said, that's nothing. We made our trailer over, I think you said, 52 times, right?
Oh yes, the trailer for Space Command, actually, I think that if you count every time that it was changed as a revision, it was like 73 times. And each time it was a little different. Sometimes it was a little better. Sometimes it was a little worse. But it was a process. It was a time-consuming, artistic process. And this is something I have found to be universally true. If you put more time and effort in, you will almost certainly get a better product. And what you're offering on crowdfunding is a product that no one has seen or heard before. You haven't made it yet. That's why you're asking for the money. So how do you tell people what something's like when you haven't even made it yet? Well, that's where the pitch video comes in. So the pitch video becomes surrogate for your product. We don't have the movie, but we've got this pitch video. So it just makes sense to make that video the best that you possibly can, because that's how people are going to judge, evaluate the quality of your work and the credibility of your ask. If I'm asking someone for money, then hopefully they have a little common sense and will want to make sure they're getting something for their money. And that's where the video comes in. So we brought in the same visual effects artist that were going to work on the film, and we had them do amazing visual effects. And we were referencing 50 science fiction, so we had examples of the finest of 50 science fiction, so people could see that this is the quality, this is the goals that we aspire to. And the talent that was going to be in the movie, we had them appear, even if it was just very briefly in the video, so people would get a sense that this is what the movie will be. And I'm not saying that everybody has to do their campaign that way. For example, if it's something that people already know about, it's a brand that people have already identified as something that they like and support, then you don't need to go quite as far. But what I've noticed is when it is an established brand, like Veronica Mars, they make a terrific trailer. It's got great pictures, it's got great sound, it's got great writing, all the performances are spot on. So even when it's already a well-known brand, the creators will still go ahead and make sure that their pitch looks and sounds terrific.
Yes, it's a key element, and I find many filmmakers don't give it the time that it needs because they're in a hurry to launch. I need the money now. I've got to launch it now. And so how much time did you give yourself in pre-production before you launched?
Pre-production for a campaign, in my opinion, it's good to allow about 6 months. And during that time, in addition to creating the visual elements, the layout and graphic arts that's going to be on your Indiegogo page, plus the video, plus supporting materials that are going to go out to social media, you also need to be cultivating the social media connections, the known media outlets, the news sources that cover whatever topic your film is about or whatever stars are in your film, plus people who are fans of you and the project itself. So it's really important to develop your Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and your media connections before you launch, because you're asking people to give you money for something that doesn't exist. You have to look really credible.
Yes, you do. Well, how many names did you have on a direct mailing list by the time you launched? Do you remember?
Oh, my gosh, thousands.
Yeah. I would think maybe tens of thousands or up to the 10,000 number. And were you successful in getting your people and on your mailing list to forward your emails or forward your information about the campaign to their friends?
Well, to some extent, we were successful in doing that. That was important, and it raised a significant amount of the budget. We found that most of our traffic, that is, most of the contributing traffic, that is, the people who actually became donors, came from Facebook and from the crowdfunding site itself.
Wow, so, that's wonderful. You
yes,
must
we
have
were
a
featured
special
because
gang out there
that,
on your Facebook
they liked it.
Because most of our films, we find Facebook does not come through with money for films.
Yes. Well, it's possible to have something that have a film, a story, a product. I mean, people have raised money for wineries and, you know, all kinds of things, everything under the sun, watches, bicycles. So it's knowing your crowd.
Knowing your crowd.
Yes. If the crowd in crowdfunding hangs out on a particular forum site, or if they communicate via a email tree, or if they go to live events, or if they all belong to some networking organization. There's just so many different places that people can hang out. And our Space Command crowd, at least the ones who donated, were mostly online. And we used a concept that's pretty well established in online marketing: thought leaders. It's probably at least half of why we were successful on Facebook and Kickstarter is by our friends responding to our call, not necessarily by email blasts, although we did use email blasts, but by posting on their Facebook and Twitter pages. For example, when Neil Gaiman, the brilliant author, posted about us on Twitter, we got a big bump. It was just so clear that his fans cared about what he said. He was a leader, and if he recommended that people check out Space Command, well, that's what happened, is people went out and checked out Space Command and donated. And we found that was true for many other thought leaders as well.
Then you really put a lot of time, attention, and energy into your campaign. How much money overall did you raise?
Well, in the first phase of our campaign, we raised $250,000, and we've raised considerably more than that since then. In other words, people kept donating after the campaign's official close. Because people
so they went straight to you, they went to your website and gave money, or the film's website?
Yes, they donated through the film's website, are, you know, for larger donors, we will meet with them in person, give them a tour of our studios, give them a sense that they're involved in the project. And that's really what this is all about. You know, this is what crowdfunding enables people to do that wasn't really ever possible before. You can support filmmaking. That was just not even a sentence that would make sense 10 years ago, because films are so expensive and it was made by the Hollywood community. But now anybody, anywhere, can support a film and help it become a reality.
Exactly. That's right. We live in such a wonderful age. It's exciting, I think, David. And you really are taking advantage of this.
Well, I've just been very fortunate to work on projects that have great stories and wonderful people creating them. And the audience has been supportive. And, you know, we'll keep doing our best for you guys.
Great. Well, talking about, let's go back to the filmmaking process. And a lot of people talk to me about when they are starting to raise money, they come to From the Heart because we're a fiscal sponsor and they sign up for our sponsorship. And in communicating with them about their needs, they often ask, when should I don't know what to budget for a composer, and I don't think I need one until post, and what do you think? And so I'd love for you to tell us all when you think that the filmmakers should contact a composer, at what stage of production.
That's a terrific question. When you're ready. I'm ready to help your process whenever you want to bring in music. There are writer-producers that listen to music that I composed either from my own imagination or at their suggestion, and that's part of their writing and creative process, is to listen to music. That's about as early as it's possible before the script is even written. And sometimes I get brought in right at the end of pre-production, when the film is about to be shot, and the director wants to have some musical ideas, musical material to work with, along with the editor, with the dailies. So the process of shooting the film and editing it and composing the music are all happening simultaneously. A couple of examples of people who do that in a very big way are Peter Jackson and Chris Nolan. Then our bring the composer in last school, which is perfectly fine. I'm good with that. If you've finished your film and the visuals are the way that you like it and all it needs is a wonderful score to elevate the proceedings, then you can bring a composer in a few weeks before the film has to be delivered for mastering, and we can put together some great music then. But our process of when to start doing all of that is controlled by the director and the producer. And it's our job to adapt to those needs.
Right. Well, let's get into this three tips for finding perfect music for your film.
Okay, well, let's start with number one. Our number one tip, and this is true for any department, is you need to budget to your production values. You need to have a good sense of how much bang you can get for your buck. And there are kind of rules of thumb, guidelines, for what percentage of your budget needs to go to different elements, like to your cast or to sets or post-production as a whole, 3% is good for music. That will match the production values of the rest of the film. And that's kind of a minimum. You can always have music that has a higher production value than the rest of the film. It will improve your quality. And that's easy to see just by checking out YouTube videos, where even if the, quote, production values are very high, if you're watching it on your computer monitor and the picture's not very big, there's just a built-in limit to how good the production values can be. But you can get tens or hundreds or millions or even billions of views if you've got good music. And that's what tends to get the highest number of views on the YouTube and other streaming video sites, are the ones that have good music. Because even if the other production values have limits on them, you don't necessarily have to have a limit on music. But you should put a bottom at about 3%.
Yeah, okay, so if you would play $1 million film, that's 30%.
Excuse me?
And come down to a $500,000 film, that's 15%. And then what if you're doing a low budget like $200,000? That would be $6,000. I mean, can you really get music that cheap?
Well, for $6,000, that's starting to get to be the low end of what's possible. There you need to look at creating another form of compensation, because there's no money for the composer at that level that just would be covering the hard costs. So that kind of deal structure means you're going to have a certain amount up front, and the rest will have to be on back end. And most films that are under $500,000 or even under $5 million have some form of participation for the creative people.
Of course. But I never thought about the composer. Of course, David, that is a great way to reward the composer.
Right. So that way you can still use that 3% number. But you're right. Well, once the budget gets under, say, $250,000, you really are going to have to be giving the composer profit participation if you want to get a good quality score. And like I said, you can do it for cheaper than that, but you'll be hurting the film because the quality of the music will be less than the quality of the other elements because you're spending all that money someplace.
Exactly. And there are all kinds of deals that can be worked out. And I think that it's up to the director and the composer to figure something that is apropos for that exact film, right? Is that how you do it?
Yes. Deals are kind of on a film-by-film basis. And when you're working with the major studios, there's a little bit more standardization, but not nearly as much as people think. I've worked for Warner Brothers with different contracts. And they were all Warner Brothers contracts, but there were significant differences between them. And, I don't mean to single out any one film company, because that's true for working with PBS or Disney or video game companies. They all work out different deals for different projects. So
right.
It's what really makes sense. And this is actually where if the deal starts to get too complicated, that's where it's really helpful to have an agent come in and help do the negotiations. If it's a small enough project, then it's possible for people to work everything out amicably as long as things don't get too complicated. But this is, again, where having a good attorney or a good agent will help to smooth the process so you can focus on being creative and making the best possible film instead of putting too much time and energy into making the best possible deal.
Well said, yes. Get to the creative side, absolutely. So budget the music to match your production values.
Yes, and at 3%, that's a good ballpark. But it's going to have to be in the $7,000 to $10,000 range just for hard costs.
Okay.
And beyond the composer can be compensated with private participation or back-end points or whatever you want to call that idea of rewarding the creative people based on how well the film performs.
Right. That's good. That's brilliant information. That gives everybody a number to play with and begin with. So now, what would you say is the second tip for finding perfect music for your film?
Well, one place where you can really improve the production value of your film, tell your story better, and get a terrific deal is by placing songs from up-and-coming bands. This is tricky, and you'll need help from a music supervisor or possibly your composer to track down bands that have a devoted, dedicated fan following who are rising and who have songs that potentially fit the film. This is a process where you're going to have to listen to a number of songs probably before you find one that's just right. But for a band that is already successful to some extent but hasn't really hit the big time yet, it makes sense to take a song that they've already produced so they don't have to invest anything into making the song and place it in your film. Those deals can often be made for basically the back-end revenue that the song makes from its broadcast and distribution with relatively little upfront money because there's a system for paying that person, the songwriter, and because it's a way of promoting them that actually makes sense for films that have meaningful distribution. So that deal is a little bit tricky because in order to ask for someone to license you their song for a very, very low price, you need to give them meaningful distribution, which means that you have to have done your homework and gotten distributors, broadcasters, some outlet that is interested in your film. And this gets into a whole other discussion of should you reverse engineer your film to fit the distribution outlets. And all I can say on that is that you'll have to have done some of that if you want to license songs for very, very little money. But that is possible to do and be a fair deal to everyone. And you'll get the fans of the band coming to see your film. And that's a big plus for everyone.
It is a good plus. That's a great idea. Well, now we have theatrical on demand because on our show we've interviewed Tug and Gather, both brilliant people who are running those companies, and their goal is to take films and put them in cities across America where the filmmaker may have a market for the film, and if they were to give their film to a distributor, they might not be in the right neighborhood. A lot of filmmakers have signed up for distribution and found they didn't make any money at the end of the day because the theaters they played in were not in the area where their crowds, where their audience lived. So theatrical on demand is another wonderful way that filmmakers can now assure themselves that they're going to be opening in maybe 10 cities based on the location of their database and where their fans are. Have you ever gotten into any of that theatrical on demand?
I think that is an amazing new development, and I'm looking forward to working with that. I may be talking to those folks soon.
Good, good. Oh, they're brilliant, both of them. And they also, they set up tours, David, where they'll take your film and put you on tour to the college market if your film fits that. And I love that idea. They have made deals all across the country for theaters in different areas, and they know what the break-even point is. So they can tell you when you have sold enough tickets to break even, and then you get to say, okay, I will green light this film, and you have 7 days to get the people who have bought tickets to bring their neighbors, friends, relatives, etc. And all of that money becomes your profits. So you don't go into any theater unless you are at a break-even and you know you can end up with profits.
I think that's a terrific idea. And I'd really like to find more about how those theaters are placed, because it seems like that would be something that you'd want to start checking out as early in the process as possible, where you can show. Are they constantly, like, growing this?
Yes, both of them are. And one of them is doing the reverse. They're reaching out to people like me who have who love documentaries, and they're finding what people like, taking surveys of what they like and what they would like to see so they can create their own list of the sci-fi lovers or the documentary lovers, and they'll know what towns they're in and what their zip codes are, so then they have a working database to support the filmmaker's database.
I think that's fabulous, and I would be really interested also in talking to the theater owners that are giving the screen time to independent films in so many different markets, because that's sort of been an issue for a long time, is where can documentaries, period, get screen time, let alone, you know, small independent ones. And it sounds like there's now a network of theaters.
Yes. Right.
Yeah, to me that's huge. That's almost like a revolution in itself.
Yes, I know. It's exciting times, David. Well, tell me, what is the third tip you can share with us about music?
Well, the third funding tip on music is that you can run a crowdfunding campaign just for the music, or just for post-production. Some folks already know about this, but it's a way to generate finishing funds as well as development money or production money. So depending on where your strengths are in funding, you might be able to get money to score your film or to do visual effects or whatever elements of the film that you still need to be funded with a campaign. And the people who have a fan base can help with that. So, for example, I've worked on campaigns where the band that had songs placed in the movie, or bands, if there's more than one, join in the promotional effort for the campaign.
That's great. So, say several bands have music in a film, and they add their database and help support the campaign to get the film funded, and it's the post-production funding, and specifically music, right? This is great.
Yes, that's useful. Now, it's important to remember the people who are best at scoring to picture are not going to be your songwriting people, because the requirements of those two different kinds of music are very, very different. And we could do a whole show on that, how you can have a brilliantly crafted pop song that's tremendously successful, but it just doesn't work in a movie. Or it can work in a movie, but only in one specific scene in one specific movie and nowhere else. And the same thing is true for film music, that you can have a score that enormously elevates a picture and saves scenes. It's really a terrific job of scoring to picture, but it's just going to work for that one picture. And if you tried to put it out in iTunes, then the sales might not work as well as it does in the movies, because there's such a big difference. And remember that you can ask your composer to help in the fundraising effort, but they're probably not going to have as many fans. And we just have to face that film music is getting more and more popular, but I may never have as many fans as Katy Perry.
Right. Yes.
Who I adore.
Oh, good. But the main thing is that the composer understands the script and can communicate with the director on what is needed and what is the energy of the film, the essence of the film, because usually there's always a subtext that goes on, and the music always tells you what's coming next, because I'll always remember the time that we did an event at my house, and you were kind mm-hmm. enough bring a film. It was Hitchcock's Psycho, and you played us a scene with her driving in the car, and she's looking in the rear mirror, and she's driving, and it was such a bland scene until they added the music, and then we felt her fear and her tension, and it was the most dramatic thing for me to see how your film is really supported by the music. Your story has to have the music to tell us what's coming and what we're feeling and all these wonderful things. So it's getting that from your composer, right? That's the best part of it.
You are so right, and thank you for being aware of music. It's something that is part of the craft of storytelling, using music. And in a way, we can say that I'm a filmmaker that specializes in music. I also make video games and television programs and live concerts, but part of what I do is make films with music. And it's storytelling, but it's a very specific kind of storytelling that has to be customized for each different picture. And what it comes down to is music is something that even professional musicians appreciate intuitively. And we can be conscious of many technical things to help give it a polish and make it all shiny, but at the end of the day, it really is how we unconsciously think and feel about the music and unconsciously think and feel about the movie that decides whether we had a good time and we liked it or not. So the composer needs to understand the story.
That's the main, that is the key issue here. And sometimes it's more than what's in the script, and that comes from a communication with the producer, director, cameraman, and the set designer, all of you working together as a single unit. And that's what puts that brilliant energy of a film on your screen. I remember talking to the producer of Somewhere in Time, which is one of my favorite films. And I said, how did you put so much love in that film? It just comes right through the television and right into your heart. And he said, it is the joint effort of the top five people involved in the film. It is their vision, and it is the unit working together with one vision that can achieve such greatness. And I think that's what you're talking about here, David, right?
Yes, yes. The topic you've touched on is profound, and I think we both know this person, Stephen Simon. Was that
yes.
who you were talking to? Yes.
Yes, Stephen Simon.
Yes. Yes, and he also worked on What Dreams May Come and other films that are, you know, wonderfully deep and powerful. You find that the directors and producers who understand the role of music and the role of collaboration as being primary importance that have the most successful films, that are consistently able to deliver wonderful, timeless art that is loved around the world. It's not one person's vision. It's the shared vision that we all are working on together. And who are we all? It needs to be the writer, the director, the cinematographer, your lead actors, the editor, the composer, and anyone else that we can get on board. But it needs to be at least those people all have to have intuitively a sense of what the story is about and what it should be. Because as soon as you try and turn it into words, you lose that nonverbal part, which is what we strongly respond to, what is the magic in the film. You can't describe it. So as a producer, I'm looking for people who get it. And I'm not looking for people who have already done what we're going to do on this film. That may or may not have anything to do with what's actually going to happen in this production, what they've done before. Yes, it's nice to have some experience, but each project is its own unique life. If you've worked on a lot of films, you know that no two of them have exactly the same story of how they came to be. There's always unique things that happen on each project. And you can't predict what those are. Those are life. They just happen. And you can react positively to it or negatively to it. And that's something that you have to see in that moment. So it comes down to finding a team of creative people who get what the story is on an intuitive level, so you don't have to talk and explain it in ways that bring down the proceedings. That's what happens when you have too many people trying to impose creative direction on the film. It's too many cooks spoiling the broth. Everybody has their own little point of view, their own little thing that they want to bring to it. And there's nothing wrong with that, except that as that number gets bigger and bigger and bigger, then it starts to become too many words, too many directions. It can't all be incorporated at once without the quality of the product suffering. So
right.
It's about being collaborative with the right people. And you can't really know who the right people are in some objective way. It's a talent. And that's one of the talents that great producers and great directors have, is they are able to sense the talent in others and whether it's a good fit for their project.
Right. Absolutely right. Well, Dave, we're running out of time, and I thank you so much. I really want you to share with us how people can find you.
Oh, yes. I'm easy to find. Myname.com, David Raiklen, DavidRaiklen.com. Or you can find me on Facebook at David Raiklen, or you can email me, David@SpaceCommandStudios.com.
Wonderful. Oh, good. Well, we have to go. We have to do another show. I want to hear what you're doing on Space Command Studios. That we didn't get to. But next time, David, okay?
Oh, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks, Claire, for a nice show.
Thank you for joining us,
and we hope next time.
Yes.
Thanks, Claire.
Next time.
Thanks,
be
Carol.
Well, everyone.
Be well. Okay. Bye-bye.
I want to remind our listeners that David Raiklen is a brilliant and talented award-winning musician who scores films and can compose music for a trio or for a full orchestra. David is a very good friend to the independent filmmaker and comes highly recommended by From the Heart Productions. If you need music to help tell your story, please contact him at davidraiklen.com. That's David, RAIKLEN.com. And Carol and I want to thank you for tuning in to The Art of Film Funding. Please visit our website at FromTheHeartProductions.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good luck with your films, everyone.